Now, frequent listeners will know that we are connoisseurs of the first inning of Cloud. We connoisseurs, maybe not by choice, but because that's just the inning that we seem to have been in since. I think S3 was launched in 2006, 2005, 2007. It's been a long first inning. However,
amen.
I was reading. Now, I didn't listen to the earnings call, didn't read a transcript, didn't this, didn't that, but I did read a few articles that quoted, the Amazon CEO now, Jassy, and he commented that their things are going great, loving it, making tons of money, but that we're just 15% into. I don't know if you rated the movement to cloud by spend. I think it was by spend or by whatever, but you know, just whatever. We're 15% in. So, you know, a lot of upside. So keep that share price going up for everyone. All told, all cool. However, now you might know better than I do. I had to go look this up, but I think baseball has 9 innings, right? Unless there's overtime, in which case there's 10 innings.
Which is called extra innings in baseball, not overtime, but go on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sure, great. Now, also, I can't do this kind of math, so I asked, or I did a math of, like, what is 1 of 9? What percentage of 1 is 9? And it's 11.11 repeating percent.
Okay.
So, if we're, I want to make this announcement. This might be the first time globally, worldwide, low Earth orbit. If the first inning is 11% into the game, that implies the second inning is 12%. Into the game, like the start of it. And if we are 15% into public cloud, we're in the second inning. Wow. Like it's finally happened.
I like it. You could even go so far as to say we're maybe in the top of the second inning. So like,
whoa.
I know, Cote, I know your thing. It's sort of like, you know, so basically each inning has two halves and they call, and because this, I think, goes back to like the way on a scoreboard, if you look, like there's like the home team and the away team. So like the home team always bats second. So anyway, so if you were looking at it, so you would say the top. So that basically means, so it's really like 1.5. It's like we're at the top of the second inning. We've just started. The team's just started to bat. So there you go. You'd be like, say, and that would really stretch. That would be a joke only we would get if Andy Jassy's like, turns out, guys, we're at the top of the second inning, which is, of course, just barely into just over the first inning. So I would love to see that, but I'm surprised I didn't see this specific use of early innings, but you know, I do love it. I have seen though many of the AWS executives are now going into we're like 5 steps into a marathon or something like that.
Oh,
I see a lot of or 10K or a long race or whatever. And so that one is, I feel like that analogy has slowly been replacing the early innings. But whatever people want to use, you know, we're good with it. You know, use your, the appropriate sports metaphor as needed.
And so, yeah, top of the second inning.
Is there
a middle or is it only top and bottom?
It's really just top and bottom because the middle is just like when they change, right? So it's just sort of like, you brought it up. I was like, oh, that there isn't, at least I don't know of like a way that that's usually conveyed, but I was thinking the same thing. It's either in the top or the bottom of the inning for the most part. So
extra inning.
We should send Jassy a note and be like, hey, this is exactly what, because again, like, you know, we know, especially at AWS, precision metrics are important. So I think us kind of going in, as like we've run the math, turns out top of the second inning, exactly where we are, Mr. Jassy.
And I was a little concerned that maybe, what if you had, as you call it, the extra inning. Mm-hmm. So what if it was elongated? I'm gonna walk you through my thinking before I realized part of it was wrong. So, okay. So if one inning out of 9 is 11.11 repeating percent, right? We got that. Now, however, if you went into extra inning, which non-sports people might call overtime, now you've got 10 innings, and that first inning is actually 10%, which is still,
like
15
it.
Is still greater than 10%. However, this got me thinking. Now, at one, right before, I don't know, the last second of the night that, let's see.
The final out of the, in baseball, it's not time. So the final, right before the final out in the ninth inning.
Before the final out, right. We didn't know. I mean, I guess you could kind of do it, but you didn't know if it was going to be a 9-inning game or a 10-inning game. And then, so then do you retroactively, does that 11.11 repeating, does that become 10%? Or is this some fourth dimensional math thing?
No, I think, I think it would become the top 10%. Then, and I think to really stretch this analogy till or beat the dead horse, as they say, I think what we could say, maybe, you know, we'll give this one to AWS for free. This is some free consulting. What they could say is be like, not only are we in the first innings, but with the advent of AI and all these new changes, we see this game likely going into extra innings. Right, it's sort of like chains. It's not just because it's no longer about just getting your workloads in the cloud or modernizing your workloads in the cloud. Now the extra innings is like, whoa, you got to go out and actually do some AI and use the LLMs, and that's really going to extend this game for a long period of time. I have to say, I think it's something they would probably latch onto. I think they would agree with that.
And then this means they're gonna bump the local news, right? Isn't that what happens?
That's right. Going to preempt the local news, and we're all going to watch more baseball, it sounds like. So that would be great.
All right. Well, good. I'm glad we got that cleared up. Now, the other thing I wanted to, maybe you've got a handle of this, but like now that we know we're 15% in, like I feel like we can start doing some spreadsheets. Like we can figure out and play around with some CAGRs, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because again, I feel like I should have looked up when S3 was launched. I think that was the first cloud thing. It's mid-2000s.
Right.
So I think, you know, that's, I can't do math in public this fast, but that's a while ago. And so like the growth, I mean, 15% is a lot of any market, but I think it would be great to do some Horace Dejewing here and compare it to like, you know, what was the growth of like the Apple II or the Mac, the Commodore, what was the growth of the iPhone? Like what, when we're talking about growth waves here, like what kind of growth are we looking at and what might we project into the future? And then we could also load in like all sorts of other things. And I think we could get a sense of like the rate of public cloudification. Now the problem there, and I'm no forecaster, but of course, like the problem with these kind of growth rates is like you assume there's an acceleration in the, what do they call it? The out innings? What's the later innings called?
Well, the extra innings, right? You know, I guess you could say. Yeah.
Well, just like, how would you describe
toward the end of seven. The game? Like, I don't know. Inning seven. I think you would just say inning seven. Late innings is probably good, right? Late in the game.
So things get fast. I don't know, but I feel like we could come up with something here to get a sense of what's going on. Because the other thing, you know, I'm always interested in like how much, where are the workloads for anything, right? And I think we're still at like, I mean, 15%, I think the charts I've seen before from IDC are that workloads, there's more than 15%. So I think that 15% is revenue. I'm not sure, though. It's confusing. But I think if we get the CAGR, we can figure it out.
We can kind of get
a sense of what's going on.
I've often said, and we can go through it because there was obviously cloud earnings this week, but I've kind of said the number out there would be, you know, $1 trillion in annual revenue spread across all the public cloud, you know.
Yeah.
That's sort of like, to me, you know, you can debate that, but I would say that's sort of like within our career spans and within our kind of stuff that we're thinking about, that's really the total addressable market. And so, you know, roughly like we saw this week, Amazon came out and said they're at a run rate of $100 billion a year now. So they made AWS made $25 billion. So you kind of add everybody together. You add AWS is 100, and then you take some liberties with AWS, with GCP as well as Azure. And so you're getting yourself at like 150, 200, you know, billion dollars of like annual run rate. So that's where we are today. And it's like, how long will it take us to get to a trillion? It's probably, it depends on the growth rate, probably, you know, in the next 10 to 15 years, it's going to be happening. Although, and kind of your original question is like, when you start to get this long, and we've been doing this, so to your point, AWS was launched in 2006, and we used to say that was 15 years ago. Now we're getting close to being able to say that was 20 years ago, right? So 20 years in, or I guess 18 years in, we're at 200 billion, right? So it's like, okay, you know, you kind of start working the math. It's like, okay, in 18 years from now, are we going to really quadruple that? Are we going to be, you know, four times the spend? That seems like pretty... That'd be a pretty big growth rate.
And so if we're 18 years in and now it's the top of the second inning.
Right.
And if we could assume, like, let's be favorable. I can't do this kind of math as fast, but like maybe if the growth rates I don't know, is 20% reasonable? 10%? Like, I guess we would have mm-hmm. to look and see what growth rates are. Then somehow, like, we can do a 30-year mortgage estimate on this. I feel like I need some sort of compound interest here, but you could project out if your target is, well, we should use the TAM that Jassy went over, because I think also in his statement, he was like, we're only 15% into the whatnot, you know, IT spend. So that's kind of like your TAM, and you can throw in some inflation adjustment as you go there.
Yeah, but so just to kind of cut to the end, so I think
it's figure it out.
10 years at a growth rate of 20%, if you're going from 200 billion to a trillion, you're looking at a growth rate of 20% over the next, which did the cloud vendors sort of like move around. I think it's not unheard of going forward, but it's probably, as the numbers get bigger, it will be harder and harder to meet.
Right. Because it also plots. Well, it might plot. I mean, as you, it's almost like a Zeno's paradox of like emerging markets is like, as you get closer and closer to the top, and not in baseball terms, but the TAM maximum, mm-hmm. you usually plateau out on adoption. So growth rate will slow,
right?
Because there's less and less people who are going to be buying it. So like, I mean, at some point your growth rate like almost stalls out because there's like, you know, five banks who haven't purchased your stuff.
Absolutely.
And like all you're doing is going after those banks. And then also you've got to survive like private equity, declining share price. So like it's probably even before that, there might be like 20 banks left who haven't bought your stuff. Mm-hmm. And so like things get weird in the later innings.
That's right.
Of stuff.
Well, I think, you know, the number of people often throw out, I know you know it, Cote, is like, I think the total IT spend from somewhere I looked up was like 4.5 trillion, right? That's like everything.
Yeah.
So that's like everything. So, you know, you're always, you know, trying to figure out if you're looking at these, like, and especially when looking at earnings, is like, well, what percent of total IT spend can the public cloud get? Now, of course, the cloud vendors would say like all of it. They'd be like 4.5 trillion is the ultimate thing. But it's like, well, I've always looked at it and be like, if you got to a trillion, that would be pretty amazing, right?
Pretty
and of course,
sweet.
Like, yeah, and of course, as time goes on, like there's, you know, you just can't anticipate all the different types of changes, right? So like something may, I know this is like probably the craziest one is like, you know, as computers quote unquote get faster, right? Is there ever a point, you know, it's almost like the DHH kind of mindset. It's like at some point, does it just get to that it's actually the computers are fast enough that for most of today's workloads, there'd be a better, cheaper way to host it outside the cloud. Is that 5 years away? Is that 10 years away? Right. So that would be interesting to do. Or do they just start charging a lot less because, you know, that was the whole theory, right? It's like, hey, the cloud spend shouldn't just keep growing. We should be able to do things faster and cheaper. Like, do prices come down over time? So, yeah, we'll see.
So, you know, related to that, as we're getting towards the later innings, obviously, we're going to be, there's a lot of automation and configuration that needs to go on. Oh, I don't know, maybe not. Maybe we stop actually needing to, that's a whole other topic. How long is this infrastructure madness going to go on? Can't we just have a SaaS? We'll find out. maybe low code will rise up and we won't have to worry about YAML anymore. We'll just worry about, you know, you just use Markdown to describe what you want and it'll be cool. Or something, but like I had an interview with a friend last week, and we skipped over talking about IBM buying Hashi, which is rumored at first, or HashiCorp, I guess, and then confirmed. I guess I didn't read close enough. I assume it has to go through like regulatory approval,
all the due diligence stuff,
sure, all that stuff. But more or less acquired, right, or being acquired. And it is an advantage of waiting, as they say, that you get to read all this other commentary. And I was in my newsletter, which is available at newsletter.cote.io. You should definitely subscribe to it. I have currently something like 750 subscribers, and we get multiple thousands of downloads for this podcast. So I know not everyone's subscribing to it. I can do that math in my head. But if you go to newsletter.cote.io, it's great stuff. I highly recommend it. It's the only newsletter you need to read. In fact, you should filter everything else out of your email inbox and just allow this to come through. It's all you need to know. Newsletter.cote.io. Anyways, I was putting some links in to like the Hashi stuff, and there was some good ones. I put in like, you know, three takes. And I was typing in like, oh, I'm trying really hard not to have a take about this. And then like 10 minutes later, I found that I'd been writing stuff and I'm like, well, what am I doing here? And I more or less just deleted it. Right. Like that was my whole thing. I didn't want to have a take. So like, it seems like I think there's two, I don't know, maybe three interesting things running around in my head. The first one, and I'll just get to it. I think, you know, Phantom co-host of the podcast, Adam Jacob, he had a long tweet thread, which is great. And at the end, I think his best take was basically just like, congratulations to all of them. They built up a huge company and brought all this value, all this stuff, which I think, you know, he's always, not always, but I feel like he's often the only person out there saying that, like, remember, acquisitions are made of people, right? Like, and these companies that were people there. And, you know, as far as I know, this is way past my time of doing anything but PowerPoint, but Terraform seems really valuable. I think it's like, that's the way that you can install Kubernetes the hard way, as I recall. So there you go. If it weren't for Terraform, maybe we wouldn't be here with the Kubernetes now. Seems like it's really important. People love it. So great. They've done that. Now, it seems like the other take was basically going to weird CAGRs and stuff is that, and I also haven't done this due diligence, but that basically like growth slowed down because they weren't able to convert sub $100,000 accounts or upsell enough of sub of over 100,000. But then it seemed like it's not that they were able to upsell, but they were only able to upsell. It's foggy in my head, but like, you know, renewal rates were like 110% instead of like 120% or something like that. Right. And the trick there being that if your renewal rate is 110%, it means you're selling more. To the same people,
right? Means you have to, right. Sell. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you're doing some landing and expanding, and so this you know, this gets to my usual thing of just like, oof, being a public company is rough because it's like you're successful, but actually you're not, right? Like you've got some problems here because people expect you to be more successful, mm-hmm. Now there's of course a third thing which I think is a more frequent topic, and I think maybe Brian over on the Cloudcast kind of because he works for Red Hat and IBM's acquiring them, I think he successfully went through the gauntlet as I have not even braved many times of talking about an acquisition that his company is doing without talking about the acquisition. he did the good trick of generalizing to open source, which was great. It's right. What you got to do. It actually gave me some thinking about how to do that kind of thing myself. But I think, as he pointed out, and I feel like he's finally convinced me, I think we just need to finally write, you can't sell something that's free. And that's the analysis of open source software. That will be my Monktoberfest 2024 talk. And I will give the other 29 minutes and 45 seconds back to you to enjoy Stephen the coffee Reed, and the oversized donuts.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I think you hit right on it. I mean, you know, it's like, as everything in life, it's just about expectations. And I think, you know, some of the numbers I pulled here was, you know, HashiCorp in 2021, you know, kind of, I think that was shortly after they were public, they were valued at $16 billion. 2022, they were valued at $5 billion. 2023, they were valued at $4.6 billion. And then they're going to exit, you know, at an acquisition price of around $6.4 billion. And so, what it comes down to is just what you said is like, I think it's all about setting expectations. HashiCorp at least initially came out and said it was going to be a growth company. It sort of presented a story, or at least, you know, propagated a story that it could, you know, grow for a long period of time. It could grow into being, you know, worth tens of billions of dollars. Ultimately, that did not happen. I would argue that like they then kind of got stuck in, like, I've seen this so many times. I've experienced it not to this level, but certainly seen it personally where, you know, you're just sort of grasping at straws. It's like, what should we do? Let's change the license. Maybe that'll make us more money. No, probably not. Let's, we should rebrand. We should put everything in a brand new, if you will, a marketing message. And that's something they call it the infrastructure cloud. And let's like put it all together. And that's going to make us grow. And that was recently announced this week. And like, again, probably not. That probably isn't going to have some magic changes. And so I think they just found themselves in that dilemma, right? Of like, okay, well, we're in a really difficult position. We're not going to grow. Our investors who got in at these other higher rates want us to grow. If we don't have an answer, then the best we can do is maybe let's get as much money for this company as we can, which makes sense, right? I think that makes sense. Like selling off to IBM makes sense. It can become just another one of the many software companies that kind of exists within IBM. IBM would be a good steward of it. They'll invest some of it, some into it. And obviously the sales and marketing can be spread across all of IBM. So it'll be one of those things where, like, I'm sure the people that go in there over the, there's usually like a 5-year acquisition plan, like, you know, business case, Cote, and there's usually at IBM like a 2-year integration. And there'll be a lot of like meetings. And I'm sure like people that get acquired will be like, the problem is IBM doesn't invest in us anymore. They're not telling us the story of Hashi. They're making us like be part of the bigger story. And we don't have direct sales and marketing anymore. And that's the problem. We're not growing. And it's like, I'll just tell you, the answer is no. The answer was like, that's not the problem. Cause you, otherwise you wouldn't have sold, right? There, IBM is sort of, if you will, putting you into a portfolio and sort of applying their scale to you and allowing you to continue to make money, but without having to spend as much cost on that. So a bunch of those people will leave the company. It will slowly be integrated. And much like we don't really talk about WebSphere and many of the other companies that exist at IBM, it will go on to be like a nice annuity business that will throw off money for a long period of time. And what you said before, people still really like Terraform. We've talked at extents about OpenTofu. We'll see what happens there. But if nothing else, the enterprise customers that want to continue to pay for Terraform will have a nice big home at IBM where they can pay for it. In fact, they can roll it in their ELAs and life goes on. So that's sort of, you know, how I see it going.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that last part is valuable for the business is what the business angle is, you know, I don't know. I think I had two little thread commentaries in our Slack channel, which you can join if you go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/Slack. And I think you and maybe also a few of the other listeners, maybe even Brian, kind of like just calm me down from my thinking out loud. But one of them, I think, I forget if I put this in there, I was just dreaming it. But like, I think maybe if at a certain point, if you want to be a open source based business, you have to be part of a giant tech company. And some of that comes in through like what you're saying is you become a feature is the wrong word.
Like a compliment almost, right? I think.
But yeah. You become part of a suite of things like a platform, right? So, and it's not, those aren't quite the right words, but it's sort of like, it's like you are an otherwise free food item on a buffet. There we go. Maybe let's try this one out. So you go, let's say something crazy happened. We also saw that Red Lobster is suffering because they were giving away too much shrimp for free. They tried to raise the prices. They didn't change the shrimp licensing, but they just tried increases. Yep. But let's say you go, you wanna, you're here in Europe, and you, well, not in Europe. Let's say you're selling hamburgers, right? Mm-hmm. Now, in an American restaurant, the ketchup is free, right? Like you just get big pumps with ketchup, mayonnaise. If you go to someplace like Hat Creek in Austin, you've got like 5 different types of sauces.
Yeah.
It's all free, right? So you go to an American hamburger place, you're paying for the burger, you're paying for the fries, you're maybe paying for a drink, but the ketchup is free. So if all of a sudden Hat Creek is like, we're going to start charging for these condiments that were previously free, it just wouldn't work. People would be like, well, I'm not going to buy the condiments. Fuck you. Right. Now in Europe never open sourced the condiments. You pay for condiments here. No free condiments unless you go to Five Guys. So I think maybe, and I already feel this analogy is breaking down, but I'm just going to power through it. I feel like maybe what's going on here is that like they're trying to sell these free condiments, but now imagine that IBM is more like a big burger buffet. And so IBM has burgers and hot dogs. You pay one entry fee and you go into the burger buffet and you can eat as many as you want if you pay this big fee. And then like, you know, it's not so much that the ketchup is free. It's included in the price of everything.
I think that's
Of course, back in the kitchen, there's all sorts of arguments about like, hey, everyone comes for the burgers. So we're going to get 70% allocation of the revenue, right? We are the ones responsible for 70% of the revenue. Frankly, it should be 90, but hey.
French fry person. We're doing you a favor by giving you 10%.
Right. Whereas like the French fry people are like, in case you forget, we had the best French fry shop in Amsterdam, which you acquired and you got our recipe. And that got you out of a burger doldrum for 10 years because people were like, you got to have the Great Amsterdam fries. So
right.
And they're like, all right. You get 10% allocation, fry people. And the fry people are like, ooh. But really, they're like, ooh, thank God. And then, you know, you go down, you got the pickle people and, you know,
oh, you got the soda people who are like, you won't even exist. Like, how would people finish these things? So they can't finish off their drinks. Right.
That's true. I think in this analogy, the soda people are like the mainframe people. They're like, I don't really care about top line revenue. Mm-hmm. Like what I'm giving you is pure profit.
Pure profit. They're so, like, look at this margin. Look at our 99.9% margin on our soda here. Like, look at you, yeah. Mr. Burger Fry person. You're only getting 50%.
The mainframe people, they just are on a different like comp absolutely, and bonus system. Right? They got their own thing going on. So, and then finally it gets down to ketchup. And ketchup is like, you know, they got to argue like what their allocation is or whatever. But the point is, if ketchup, little packets of ketchup were to go to the street corner or the side of the street and try to sell ketchup on its own, everyone would be like, why am I going to buy ketchup? Yeah. I don't want to buy ketchup.
I'm hungry.
Right?
Where's the rest
but
of
now,
the stuff?
Yeah. Now you're part of the big blue burger buffet, and I really snuck that alliteration in there. You're really part of the big blue burger buffet, and you know people are buying the ketchup because it's all bundled into the main thing. And I don't know. I think maybe that is the kind of the end state of good successful open source is that it's really hard to have an independent business, and so even like the example of an independent open source business, Red Hat, eventually you just, not just, but eventually you're part of the big blue burger buffet and you're kind of all wrapped up into that one price and it's fine.
And I think to your point, right? I mean, it's all about, it's kind of, this is kind of what Adam Jacobs doing, right? He's sort of like it's redefining success. It's like, hey, if we, at the beginning of Terraform and Hashi and all this stuff, at the very beginning, when this thing started, we said like, hey, we think this company can be sold by $6.4 billion. And we went to the VCs.
Exactly.
Everyone would be like, that's incredible. You'd be one of the biggest success stories ever in open source. Sure. But, you know, because we all know the history and because of all the expectations, you know, some they made on their own, some because they took venture capital and all of these choices, you know, there's this perception that it's, you know, it didn't do as much as it could have. But I'm slowly coming to the point that, you know, I think Brian's, you know, kind of, I don't think he said it quite this way, but it's really is at the end of the day, you know, selling there's a real cap on how big an open source company can get. And if you want to stay independent or you want to, if you will, reap most of the profits for yourself, kind of at margins, like you just cannot take venture capital and you cannot get into these growth.
Yeah.
Right? So it's almost like an analogy would be like the Ben Thompson Stratechery kind of model. It's like, if you really want to kind of control it and write software and things like that, you got to bootstrap yourself. You got to keep the team very, very lean. And, you know, and you can have a huge success, but it will require a lot of effort on your own and a lot of risk, which may or may not be helpful to you. But at the end, right, it can get, you could, if you will, keep most of that $6 billion for yourself. But as soon as you take venture capital and you start to like bring in all the sales, marketing and development expense, and most importantly, as soon as you confuse building an open source community for being, you know, lead generation and you believe you're going to convert, you know, some percentage of those open source users into paying customers, like you're already on the path to failure, right? It's like, it's never going to come true. You're never going to be like, I'm just going to keep converting the open source community at a high rate and they're going to keep paying me. It's like, no, that's never going to work. So don't do that. And the venture capitalists that want you to try that, like you need to tell them, no, it's just, is not going to happen. And the sooner, and I think, you know, it would be great. I was thinking about this too, to your kind of some earlier comments, like using the CNCF landscape, right? Like instead of just having the landscape, I really think there would be like, it would be maybe some enterprising financial person can do it. It would be like, go through each one of these companies and those projects and really start to put a value on like, what is it ultimately going to look like for these companies? Because they're not all going to be billion-dollar companies. In fact, very few of them will be, right? Most of them are going to be small tuck-in acquisitions will be the best most of these companies can do, right? And it's like, and just kind of say it in like very definitive terms. This is what it is. Like pick any one of the standards, right? Like, you know, maybe I was thinking of like Spiffy, that's sort of like one of the open source projects around access controls and identity and stuff. I'm like, That project is not going to be worth billions of dollars. The commercial companies associated with it are not. And it's like, I don't know. And I think maybe almost like having like an open dialogue. Does everyone understand that? Everyone that's working on these things, like you're not going to have these huge outcomes. Now you're not going to convert your open source base over. And are you like, does everyone good with that? You know what I mean? Like before you keep going, it's almost like a check-in. Before you keep going on this project, do you understand that? Or are we sort of all believing under some false pretenses there?
I'm trying to have this week and maybe last week, I've been trying to have the following thought in my head without it being cynical. And I'm always trying to be more positive in my life, but it feels like if you've found an open source business, you're only doing it towards a cash out, right? Like not for like a long-term sustainable thing, because eventually like, you know, if you found the business, if it does get purchased by someone, you are going to become wealthy and you're going to want to like leave probably. I don't know. Maybe there's a few like founders who stick around and they keep doing stuff, but it's almost like, and then you couple that with what we were just saying, that it's difficult, you know, in contrast, just whatever, like Michael Dell is still at Dell, right? Not an open source company. in many ways. I mean, it's a hardware company, right? And so like, and a lot of the, you know, at other companies, there are like long serving multi-decade executives at those companies, right? And, but I feel like a lot of, I don't know, open sourcey companies, like, are there, like even with Red Hat, I wonder like what the longest tenure of people at Red Hat are who are like executives, right? Like the big one there. But it seems like eventually you're looking for like, not an escape, but you sort of like want to do something more interesting. Yeah, maybe this is just a problem with startups in general, but it all, and again, I'm trying not to have this too cynical, but like it gets to this point where like, I think only really big companies can quote unquote do an open source business, because otherwise what you're doing is you're just sort of like getting some venture funding to gambling on yourself, but to hope that there's some big cash out event, in which time you pass it on to one of those big companies anyways.
Right. Or, you know, to what you're saying is like, you know, what we're seeing emerge now would maybe be like, if you really just are passionate about working on the open source project and you believe it has, you know, some type of value, you know, going forward, probably the thing that makes the most sense is to go work at one of the large cloud providers at this point as either a key maintainer or even an open, you know, even the kind of the project leader, right? Because those are the places where, and that's kind of what we're seeing. And I, you know, that's sort of like maybe there's a whole nother topic of discussions, but really a lot of these projects, especially when you look at CNCF, it almost becomes sort of like, what do the public cloud vendors, as well as a few other, you know, I'll throw VMware and Red Hat in there, like what inside of there, what projects do they deem valuable that will help them provide some type of managed services for their various businesses? And they're going to kind of pluck those out, right? And they're and there's sort of like this informal agreement, right? It's like, you know what? We don't really want to compete on this. It would be better if we all just had the same thing, right? You could say Kubernetes is an example of that. We could say Hashi to some extent. I'm sure everybody at Google, AWS, and Azure, like, they're probably very happy. Like, great, IBM owns it. IBM's really not a direct competitor anymore. It'll be like, just again, it doesn't really provide any differentiation. So they're like, that's a great holding place for it. So you almost want to come back to like, if I'm passionate about a technology, I want to build a community around it, and I believe I've got some specific functionality these cloud providers are going to do, is like, go become a maintainer and go work at one of those providers and let them just pay you to do that work. That way you don't have to do all this other like raise capital, hire sales and marketing, you know, all the hard things about a company. And I think that going forward is one avenue. Now that brings up other issues. Maybe that's not what we want all these open source projects to be, right? Maybe we don't want them just to be in this de facto like try monopoly kind of thing. But unless something else happens, right? The belief that all these companies are going to have open source projects and all these enterprise companies are going to buy all the open support and the licensed versions of the CNCF of the hundreds of projects in there. It's like, that's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen.
I like where you're going with this, because it's making me realize my framing you've corrected my framing. I like your framing better, which is the focus should be, as always, Brandon, you want to focus on customer value.
Of course, absolutely.
Every junior, little NBA minded person will tell you that customer value. So, which is to say, the sustainability of open source. That's what the question is, right? Yeah. Like the business, whatever, right? Like that's business is last thing on a customer's mind. As we know, the customer is always right, except when it comes to pricing. And
yes.
And so, but if you want, this would be you could kind of figure this out, like by, I don't know, scientifically is the wrong word, but you could do some kind of surveying of history and say, what are the top 40 sustained open source projects, right? And, you know, I don't know if it's fair to have like, you know, the little thing where there's one maintainer, although that would actually be a good, yeah, I mean, you would have to have that in there too. You want to see like, if you look at the top 30, 40, whatever open source projects, the longest lived ones, like how have they sustained? Do they have independent companies that are only dedicated to that? Or are they just part of your, you know, the top 5-6 cloud companies or tech companies?
Right.
And therefore, like, my theory would be that what you're going to find is that if you, as you were just saying, if you want to sustain open source, achieve customer value, then it basically has to be at one of the big companies. And then therefore, it's great. I mean, I'm just summarizing what you said. But and therefore, if you are an open source person, oddly enough, you want to go work for one of the big companies, because that's going to be your best sort of bet at taking care of customer value.
Yeah, I think so. And I've been thinking kind of, I guess, a different way to think about this whole problem would be like, for the next person that's going to start like an infrastructure software business of any kind, right? Like, and maybe Adam Jacob and others are kind of doing this, but like, you know, don't actually start at making it open source. Actively don't. Be like, I believe we have a customer value a problem. We believe this problem is solved, can be paid for, and start that way, because it forces you up front to really go learn whether or not people will actually pay for it. And if you wanted to, for example, you could have a free tier. Be like, I'll have a free tier at this level or whatever, right? For some period of time. But like, you sort of want to chain yourself to like, no. I'm not making this decision until I've proven out what the value is to this actual group of customers. And then at some point, once you've done that, you could say, well, turns out I can't get anyone to buy it, right? And maybe that's a reason you make it open source, because you're just like, I still think it's valuable, but maybe it would be more valuable in a foundation, and maybe I could go work on it because some other big company wants to hire me to do that. Or, you know, you kind of go through the process of like, well, you really do learn what's valuable, and maybe even learn like which segment is valuable and what they value in general. And you say to yourselves, well, I'm going to carve that off and I'm going to sell that going forward. And I've decided proactively that I can actually open source this other part of it, which I think is going to be really useful. Like, I think monitoring kind of does this by default, right? Like there's not like some big meeting, but like there's kind of like, hey, let's all just use the same monitoring data. Let's use the same agents. Like there's so many, I think, you know, Matt had somebody on here. I think it was, oh, you know, OpenTelemetry. Everyone let's just use the same data. And we all agree, and that's fine. But we then are going to sell you the reports and the charts and the various ways to be alerted on it as separate. And I think, but there's been, that's kind of, if you will, been found out over a long period of time. So, you know, to the next person that's doing it, I would not do default open source. You need to do something else. Like default closed source, go try to sell, figure out what value you're bringing to the table, what people will pay for. Then only if it makes sense, go back and make some component of it open source, or determine that like the whole project needs to exist as an open source project. And I think, you know, we talked about the cloud providers, but certainly Netflix comes to mind, Lyft comes to mind as companies that have developed, you know, infrastructure components that were not core to their business that they open source as well. So that's another thing to do, right? If you can invent it inside, and those companies don't care at all for the most part. They want open source because they don't have to maintain those things. But like, I think again, like you got to go through all these decisions at the very beginning. If you take the venture capital and then, you know, you have the, I'm going to convert so much of the open source community to paid. It's like, you're done. I'm going to tell you, you're going to leave this party very unhappy, maybe crying. So you know, that's how it's going to go.
Have you ever had to tell someone they're going to leave the party, maybe crying?
I don't know. Have I?
I mean, literally.
I don't know if I've told anyone that. I've seen people leave the party crying, but I've never. Oh. I don't think I've ever told anyone that. Not because of
and
me.
And it's not even their party.
Yeah, there's something bad happened, right? You know. So.
All right, so I want to you know, I'm as I was saying before we were recording, I'm on vacation this week, so I got all sorts of weird thoughts going through my head. If I don't have the sponge of work to pull the weird thoughts out, they coagulate and whatever. That's the opposite of running around, but whatever. Here's a little tip: if you forgot to clean a greasy pan the night before, you can just heat it up a little bit. And it uncoagulates, and then it's runny, and you can just pour it into a can. Yeah. And you don't have to worry about scooping it out. It's good stuff. Anyhow, I don't necessarily believe the following. This is just in the old sense of academic, which means just like bullshitting for fun. Let's do a little thought experiment here. So I think one way of thinking about what we just said is that it's a really bad idea to start an open source business. Because it's hard and there's better things to do. So now that would imply, and then we go back to the talk from last year's Monktoberfest about why open source VC funding is as it is, which has no answer. I think the answer to that was don't do it, if you remember that presentation. That which is hard to say if you're a VC who funds open source companies. But I think you would want to conclude like we should stop funding open source companies and instead we should fund software companies, right? And we have to make sure they have something to sell, and whether that's done through a SaaS or it's done through closed source software, whatever, right? So then that would mean that the era of open source software from companies is sort of like, it's not at an end. We don't get to that yet, but it means that the large companies now, and rightly so, they use open source just because it's better, right? Just like, you know, as I'm always citing, if you go back to the part two, the top part of the Kubernetes documentary, there's a great part where I think it's Craig and also Joe Beta are like, they don't talk like that. They talk more professionally, but they're like, we couldn't, Amazon was rough and we couldn't get, we weren't selling Google App Engine. So we needed to figure something out. So we decided to go in and basically, this is a different use of open source than when Spolsky wrote up this commodifying compliments. But we wanted to standardize how infrastructure was done in cloud. So Amazon didn't have the proprietary hold on it. And I think it worked, right? As I'm fond of tracking, like by no means do all workloads globally and in low Earth orbit run on Kubernetes, but it's what everyone thinks. And we'll see over the next couple of years, they got to get over that OpenStack bump, but sure, it seems on a trajectory to do that. So they did a great job with that. And I think in the public cloud, it probably is a good like standard and API for representing things. So you have the big companies, as you were saying, coming together, and they're basically like, it's better for all of us if we have a standard, sort of like, you know, screwdrivers. It's just like all of the different screwdriver companies are probably not like, we all have our own proprietary screws that don't work with the other screwdrivers. Or like if you're a bread company, you're like, we don't really have, you know, batshit crazy types of bread. All of the bread fits with the stuff you put on it. You particularly see this. You know, in America, we basically have the square bread paradigm. Most of the bread you get is going to be square. Now, in the Netherlands, that's the rarity. That's called the casino bread because you cook it in this metal container that's kind of like a house, like a casino, and it crisps it on all sides. That'll blow your square bread American mind to have crisp bread on all sides.
Right.
But the predominant bread they have in the Netherlands is actually rectangular because when you go to the store, you see that the bread, the integrated sandwich system is the cheeses are long rectangular slices and the meat are long rectangular slices. So it's a whole integrated system, but all these parts are coming from different people, but there's obviously a standard for the bread size and all this. So anyways, you can see that in the infrastructure, the programming, the cloud space, all of those vendors, they want to have a standardization of all the various components. Like it's better for them just to be working on it. And so then if there are no sort of like new open source companies coming up with open source things, that sort of responsibility goes all to the big companies to like fund doing this stuff. And, you know, there's like back and forth with it. Like, I'm sure at some point in Amazon, this is not in the documentary. They're only like a mysterious drone shot in the documentary. But like at some point in AWS, they were probably just like, you know, they're like, just fuck it. Stop writing the memos and the press releases. Let's do it. Right. Yep. Like, we're just going to like do the Kubernetes and go write a press release on that and a FAQ. And so they just kind of conceded to it. And now they probably, you know, do a lot of, I think they do a lot of work there, you know, in that
EKS,
area.
Amazon EKS for sure. Mm-hmm.
And so it's not always like a priori, like virtuous thing that you get involved in it, but it's more of that the sort of like open source community just moves to big companies that already exist because it's sustainable. And then the final thing is that shifts the role of foundations into like, I don't really know what it shifts them to. Maybe they keep doing the same thing. I mean, how many foundations are there anymore? There's not that many. But like, they more are like standard setters. I'm not really sure like what that role is. If it's basically just like, you know, you as a foundation, there's 10 possible members that you're working for. But maybe more of their role is like, if you're those big 10 tech companies, like you need a neutral party. You need an arbitrager. It's like you have that person who's the arbitrator for all of this, the kind of,
well, I think you're
and
right.
I guess they also can hold the trademarks and the copyright and all that kind of stuff.
No, but it really does. I think you're exactly right. I think it's slowly kind of becoming that, right? I think it's becoming a place like it's the neutral place where everyone agrees, you know, that, hey, we'll put it out here, but that most of the profits at this point are probably going to go to the large cloud providers, right? The idea that you can be a standalone open source company focused in on just one kind of piece of infrastructure, probably very, very difficult. There's only going to be a few winners like that. So if that's, you know, and again, like, I don't think anything necessary, I think it's just expectations. I think venture funded open source companies are likely never to, if you will, reach the value that investors want. Doesn't mean you can't open source a project, maintain it, contribute to it, and find a way to make money off it for yourself, or to maybe ultimately sell it, you know, in like a tuck-in acquisition to another large vendor, right? But I just think when I look at that sea of logos, I believe there are many people with, like, you know, the slide. We joke about the hockey stick slide, right? Where it's like, no, because the hockey stick slide is always like, well, then the community starts converting to paid customers, and it's like, no, that's not going to happen. I'm sorry,
right.
I'm not going to do
it. And then I guess a follow up, a codicil, is that what you, whatever to this is,
it's extra innings, like, to go in extra innings on this subject, Kote?
This is the extra inning. That's right. Is I think, and so if that sort of thing goes true, for the most part, if there is an open source startup, the only point of that startup is to be acquired by a large tech company. Like, if it does IPO, then that's just, you know, a cash out moment. Like, I mean, I guess I'm kind of throwing some like ethical light on it that, like, that's just sort of like not cool, right? Like, you're taking advantage of the exuberance to get some money. Like as an example, I've been sorting through, you know, you remember COVID, My everyone's houses in COVID went up in, like, I feel like 180-200% value.
Yeah,
like
a lot,
right? But then nowadays you go look at those values and they're more or less back to where they were. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in my mind, it's like, oh, so that was all fake. However, if you did sell your house, it was worth that amount. This is a problem with like pricing, is like that was actually not the real value of it. And similarly, like if you look at a lot of companies, they go up in value and then down. It's sort of like, well, were they really worth $20 billion? Or was that not
well, but real? I would say there it's just expectations, right? It's just sort of like there was a point, right? I mean, we have the number, $16 billion. There was an expectation that a bunch of people had that it would grow and people were willing to buy into that, right? And I think what we're saying here, and again, not that we know for a fact, but I think we're just sort of saying historically, this really doesn't happen in most cases. So sure, you can be, and it's not like no one's going to stop you. It's like, if you want to take venture capital and start an infrastructure company, you can do it. There will be an outlier or two that do really well. In fact, we can argue that Hashi is an outlier. The one they made it to like the $6 billion, right? It's success, even though there's some, you know, maybe disappointment around it. Mm-hmm. It's just, I think for the vast majority of these companies, it's like, you're never going to get there. And you're really, if you will, open source is really just tricking you, right? This adoption you're seeing of use of your product is because it's free. That's really what it is. It's because it's free. It's not even because it's open source. It's because it's free. That's what people like. And when it comes to the day, people don't want to. So it kind of comes back to like almost like the very beginning of these projects. It's really about your personal intent if you're the one building it. It's like, it's almost like a hobby versus a career. It's like you can make music because you think it's fun. And I just want to release music. And I, you know, maybe a small group of people like it. Who knows? Maybe you'll get a chance to, if you will, play at a club, sell some t-shirts, make a little bit of money. I mean, you can do that, but no one's fronting it. That's completely different from like, I'm going to take money from a record label. I'm going to like, you know, sell out. I need to be the next, you know, Taylor Swift or whatever, make billions of dollars. It's like, it's just very unlikely that's going to happen. Right. And it's like, and if you're going to do that, right, you kind of like, it's like different intent. So I think when you start an open source company with the intent of like, we want to build a valuable business and we want to make sure that we make good money and we also really return to investors, it's like, okay, you've said a lot of things there, but you don't really have to be open source to do that. And I would even argue at the beginning, it may kind of throw you off the track. It would be better to challenge yourself to go build that business in a more traditional sense than try to start with open source, because it's going to really distract you, would be my guess.
Yeah. Hmm. I like the notion of open sourcing at the beginning of your software business is like empty calories that you're going to regret later. Like it's like this artificial boost that you're going to get that really is not cool.
And maybe, you know, difficult. I don't know, Kote, you know, one that was maybe close to us, but like Nagios, right? Like, you know, my running joke on the show is like, you know, the number one monitoring solution in the world is Nagios. Like everyone has it. And, you know, I don't know. I was trying to look here to make sure. It's like, I don't think they've ever raised money. They have some commercial solutions. It's out here, but it's mostly just a project. It's like people keep it going. It gets used. It's not probably ever going to be acquired for billions of dollars, but it probably is the most successful monitoring solution in the world. And it's like different goal, right? Completely different goal than like starting the open source monitoring solution and like trying to get it bought out. And it's like, what is your goal? What did you want to do? I would say Nagios, incredible. Maybe the most successful monitoring solution, right? Datadog, not open source to my knowledge. I'm sure maybe they have some open source components, but they're like, hey, we're just going to sell you a SaaS version, right? There's a good example. I don't think anyone's confusing Datadog as they're like in it for the open source or in it for the monitoring. No, they're in it because they built a good solution. They can make a lot of money. Nagios, really, for the most part, is in it because like, hey, we think this is a good solution. We're not going to deal with venture capital. Very successful in their own right on their own terms.
Right. I mean, you know, SaaS company might as well be a closed source company. No need to worry about that. Like, it's fine. Like you've actually got something to charge for that's proprietary, closed, only available from you for a price.
And really, it seems like to me, it's like if you're having this conversation, if we're having this conversation at the beginning of a company, it's like probably this is the first question. It's like, can we build this into a SaaS company? If the goal is to take venture capital and make as much money as humanly possible, can we do it that way? Is there a way that we can do it that way? And if the answer is no, then go back and like think some more. But if the answer is at all, yes, that's how you should start. Start it that way, right? That seems like it's going to give you the path to value. And I think, you know, we outside of infrastructure software, you know, we don't see this stuff play around or kind of pan out the same way. It's like Salesforce, for example, always been a SaaS company, right? Like all the companies in the world pretty much need CRM. And I guess there is Sugar CRM, but like it's dwarfed in comparison to Salesforce, right? And it's just like, there isn't like a whole bunch of people that are like, oh, you know, I'm not using the CRM system because it's not open source. And this applies to all business software. And it's like, well, if the goal is to make money and you want to just provide value, then like, you know, in business applications, we don't worry if it's open source at all, right? Someone builds a good solution, maybe we use it, maybe we don't. And, you know, I think it's secondary if you know, if the source code is available.
I think we figured that one out, Brandon. I was really just scraping the bottom of my mind.
I think I would, you know, in the Slack or wherever else, I think some people out there probably believe, you know, maybe disagree. So like send us an email, tell us, you know, what's right or wrong. Like, you know, why, if you believe like every business should be open source, tell us why you believe that and like why it's successful. And, you know, we want to make sure we represent all sides.
And I think what I was struggling in my brain to formulate. So it's good you gave me some time. Is like, I think that also So if we have this proposal for a reevaluation of the open source business, I don't know what it is. Maybe we can get into it in the future, but it also implies at least revisiting and verifying, if not reconsidering, using open source software. Not that, don't get me wrong, not that you shouldn't use open source software. You'd be crazy not to. But more of just like, I don't even know what the answer is, but like there's something in and something in there to consider, because I mean, I think that's a lot of the problem over the past few years is people feeling like whether they're users of it or people who've contributed to it, like feeling some kind of rug pulling about what's going on, right? And especially if you're a larger business using free open source and then licensing stuff changed around, like I think Oracle and Docker and like a few other people have like changed the nature of it, so you have to pay for it more. Like, no one wants to be like, you should have known better, the caveat, screw you, whatever that Latin is. But like, you know, it does mean maybe there's like a different way to think about when you're using open source stuff from this angle that we're discussing. We should figure that out at some point. But what I wanted to get to next, Brandon. While we're, like I said, I've been on vacation, lots of time to think about stuff. I think it was last week at the last newsletter I sent out was like, I looked at the CD Foundation survey to see what's going on there. And I don't think I'm reading this wrong, because I've gotten some people emailing me to say yes and not wrong. But my read of it is that 71% of people are not automating their builds and tests in software development, which is to say 29% of people are using continuous integration in the surveyed base. Now, this is from the CD Foundation, which I assume a lot of the people they're getting to answer it are like, know what CD and CI stand for, right? Kind of like this is actually maybe not an accurate statement on my part, because like the CNCF, they outsources the inaccurate word, but they partner with, they use Slash Data, who just has general development survey of like tens of thousands of developers, if not more. So I think what they do is they go to Slash Data and they have them take a, as we used to say in the Red Porsche days of M&A, a cut of the data and kind of pull this out. So I think it's pretty general, like developers, not just people who would, you know, for example, I bring this up, I'm thinking way too much about this, but like, you know, they put out a call to do the various DevOps surveys, and you know the DevOps enthusiasts are going to go there, right? Mm-hmm. So you probably have a lot of their people who are DevOps enthusiasts, which is fine. I'm sure you can control for all that in science. But so this seems pretty genuine, but I feel like, you know, I did a little bit of the math, and I think according to Wikipedia, Grady Booch proposed the term continuous integration in 1991. And then, as I recall, in extreme programming, automating your build was very important. It was one of the key, I don't know, they have 12, 14 principles. And that XP book came out in 1989. And they were probably talking about it a little bit before then. So like, it's been a long time since we've sort of known that automating your build is good, but it seems like we're just at 29%. Let's call it 30. It seems, if I think about it too much and I don't have that mind sponge, it sort of makes me think like, what are we doing here, Brandon, if people haven't automated their build? Now, 30% is better than 0% or 10%, but still this growth rate seems a little troubling.
Well, is it,
like something strange is happening.
I'm not sure I saw the exact wording of it. Is there any wiggle room there? Is it like fully automated? Is the answer, it's like 29% of fully automated everything versus like, you know, like there's some wiggle room where like, well, maybe we didn't do everything, but we automated like most of the stuff, you know, is there some?
Well, so definitely there's wiggle room. There always is, right? Especially since I've been looking at the data. But I did send this to Lawrence, who I worked with at 451 Research. Is it Lawrence Hecht? I should know how to say his name. I apologize. But I worked with him at 451 and he does some analysis for the new stack, because I was like, what am I missing here? And he replied back and he was like, well, the most important thing you're missing is that they asked individuals if you are involved in building and automatically building and testing your software. And so he was like, so maybe he was much more succinct, but like what he's saying is like, so you could have a team of 10 people and two of those people could be the ones who are quote unquote involved in automating your building and testing. And the other eight people are like, oh, I'm not involved in that. So okay. That could be an interpretation of it. However, okay. if I was asked that question, I would be like, yes, I'd use automated builds in CI, right? Because I would be like, am I involved in it? That's different than adminning it or running it. Like, I guess the question that you want is like, per team,
is it done, right?
Does
is,
that just team ask them, use like,
is your build, yeah, is your build and test system automated? Period.
Right. So let's we could even throw in, 20% more for the ambiguity of the question.
Right.
And still, so then we're at like 50%. That's pretty good. But it also just seems like at this point, if you're not automating at least your build, let alone your test, never mind even like auto deploying to production, that as a developer, as a team lead, maybe even as a manager, it could be even the VP of applications, you're just willfully saying no, right? Like
I don't know. I would go a little bit different. I'd say it's like, you know, one, you know, it's in just another example of the defaults, you know, status quo bias, defaults, lifestyle, whatever you want. It's like, there is so much software out there today, right? That has existed for a long period of time. That's been a certain way that people are very slow to change. Right. And so it's kind of like, you know, we talk a lot about Kubernetes on this, but I always kind of say it's like, most of the stuff runs in VMs, right? Like even after however many years we've been talking about this, or even the cloud, right? You know, Andy Jassy would sit here and say like, you know, gosh, after 20 years almost, right? We got 10% running in the cloud. Who's, you know, why are people buying all these servers still? Why do we still have this stuff on site, right? And it's like, well, because like just things are very, very slow to change. So I think when you kind of like take a broader lens and you look at like just take the United States government, all the software that exists in there. I'm like, I'm sure lots of that software is not automated and probably won't be automated anytime soon. And so like, you know, kind of like it's something I think maybe you guys talked a little bit on with your interview last week. It's like, will the change, right? I think the guest was talking about like, if we make it sound scary and complicated all the time, people don't do it. And like, there's all these things. And, you know, sort of a quick aside is, you know, I thought it was funny this week, you know, Edward Norton, the actor, you know, launched this company Zek, which was all about like, basically how to present to the, like boardroom, right? You know, basically, and his pitch is to stop doing PowerPoints for the board of directors. And I'm like, perfectly reasonable suggestion. But I'm like, it's not that the software doesn't exist. It's like culturally, right? The way a board of directors wants to be communicated to and the way people want to do it is using a slide deck. And like the fact that there isn't software to change that isn't the problem. Right. And I think that's kind of the same thing with this automation. It's not that like people don't know, it's not out there. It's just like in a lot of places, there's probably not the will to make the change. And if so, it can take a really long time. And we probably overestimate when we see successes. We're like, why doesn't everyone do it that way? And we just assume it's so self-evident. It's like, no. There's lots of reasons people aren't going to do it. And I think that's what always is going on there.
All right, that's good because I've been trying to turn this frown upside down since I wrote this in the new that wrote this up, and I think you're kind of what I've hit on is that what this means is that there is no end of the thought leadering that needs to happen for the next 10 years or so, right? Like if you kind of like me, like if you're like, I don't know, I've been saying the same thing for like 5 to 10 years, like how to improve doing software and stuff like that. It turns out needs to be said a lot more. There's a lot of room, all sorts of people. Let's even in our charitable case, 50%. And you know, there's always going to be, I don't believe in that. Is it the Petro? I don't believe in that 80-20 spread. That's a bunch of bullshit. So like, let's say there's 10% of the people, the laggards who are never going to convert over. Right. So we're still talking about a solid 35-40% of people out there, even if we had that super favorable 50% cut, or like, you know, 60-70% if we're going with the less favorable cut. And so like, you just got to keep going out there and being like, check it out.
Well, I think also I would say too, it's just like celebrate the successes. Like we talk a lot about like how much hasn't been done, but like, you know, on the show, like I like to point out all the time, right? Like, oh, you know, it's like, wow, this has been automated. I can order ahead at a Sonic. There's an app, right? And I can order.
But this is true. This is the confounding thing, right? Is like as that like software had from a customer value perspective,
right?
The application development has clearly gotten better, right? Like the apps that we use day to day, phenomenal. So
or banking. I always
just
think
keep
like
progressing.
The one for, you know, most of the people listening to this, although unfortunately maybe we're getting to like the older side, is like I, you know, banking is still a great example because, you know, when I was a quote unquote real adult, right? Like, I mean, all your bills came in the mail. You had to write checks. You put a check, you had to literally mail it back with a stamp, right? And that's how it started. I mean, this is not that long ago, I guess, depending on who you are. This is like the 90s, late 90s, right? And then there was like, automatic bill pay, right? At least you got your bill in email. And that took a long time. And then you got to the point of like, oh, I could like bill it to maybe a credit card, right? And then you got to the point you could check your balance and things like that. So like when you look over this, like that history, it's like banking is just revolutionized in the, like, you know, kind of art, still close enough to like, we saw it happen, right? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
like what people think about today. So like you see these successes and they happen over a long period of time, but like, and I think, you know, the government's a good example because sometimes we pick on them, but like, hey, at least here in Texas, you can renew your driver's license sometimes online and you never talk to anyone. And it's a miracle. Now, when you go get a driver's license, you know, there's very little automation inside there. So I think it's just like, you know, we just underestimate how long it takes. Right. But at the same time, we should always take stock to be optimistic to your point. A lot has changed and a lot of things are automated. And that's what you just kind of have to keep your eye on. At least the way
I like this. I think this is turning around I'm starting to feel that I got a new thing here to talk about for the next 10 years. I just got a slightly, I got an executive dinner coming up in Atlanta next month. I think I might start with like, let's all start with a gratitude journal entry. Rather than like the way this stuff usually goes, we all complain about stuff like things that are wrong, but like, hey, what's going right?
Right. And I think you had a thing this week about LLMs, right? You sort of like kind of, you know, you sort of kind of phrased it as like, I kind of reached their limits, what you can do. But like, I think someone on the other side of like, I both agree with you, but also like, man, this is great. I just have this like part-time editor. They're always with me. My little LLM editors. I love it, man. They're just like, I have them go through. I have them correcting my grammar mistakes. And then I have them rewrite stuff. And I love it, man. I'm just like all day long. I'm just like sitting there using it. And it's like, is it like revolutionary? But no, it's not revolutionary. But like, has it like allowed me to like write better emails and like write documents faster and more clear? 100, like, I don't know exactly how to quantify it, but like a million times, you know what I mean? Like, cause it's always ready to catch all my errors. Like I don't need to ask anyone to proofread it. Right. It's like, it's always ready. It always finds, oh, that's the wrong verb or whatever. And it's like, awesome. Like to me, it's like, fine, mission accomplished. I know everyone wants like autonomous robots to take over, but I'm like, you know what? Just a great editor that's with me all the time. I'll take that. And also I just like it also too. It's like, I just like when it just like takes all the things it knows and just writes me a short paragraph. It's like, I don't have to go to Wikipedia. It's like, what is this? Just give me a short paragraph on that. Yes, I know it can often be inaccurate, but if you're just asking basic facts, it's usually, you know, very similar to Wikipedia. So it's like, okay. So it's like glass half full, glass half empty kind of thing. It's like, wow, that's a miracle. You can do that. Or it's like, wow, is that all it does? Well, like right now it isn't. It kind of is, right? You wouldn't trust it with more complicated things.
We mentioned this with the company valuations. You have these expectations, right? And like with the AI or ALLM or generative AI, whatever the fuck you want to call it, like it's easy to forget when you're messing around with it that you're trying to figure out the edge of its potential. Right. And then the closer you get to the edge, the more normal that seems. And then you finally get there and you're like, oh, this thing isn't useful.
Yeah.
But you've forgotten all the other stuff, which is useful. But I agree. There's all sorts of stuff it's great for. And I think I've found that that edge of it or whatever. Speaking of finding edges, Brandon, do we have any bureaucracy this episode?
Let's see. We don't have any major bureaucracy, but I just would like to say maybe two things. One, of course, if you would like a sticker, send your postal address to stickers@softwaredefinedtalk.com, and I will be happy to send you a sticker anywhere in the world. In fact, I will even be able to send you another sticker if I write the address wrong. It goes all the way to Amsterdam, and then it comes all the way back, and they say like, I forgot to write the street number. But it had everything else. I was like, that was a long round trip, but that's okay. It was my mistake. I'll do it. And then one other thing, we don't have to get into it this week, but I just sometimes like things just happen and it doesn't really matter what political, if they just align with your interests, you'll just immediately go to their side. And this is an example of one. It's like the FTC has announced that they're going to ban non-competes. And I'm just like, 100% for this. I don't, you know, suddenly I'm totally in on Lina Khan. I love it. I'm 100% this idea. I have just so many non-competes. I've seen it misused so many times with like friends and different corporate situations. It's like, man, it would be great just to be done with non-competes forever. I know the people in California are like, why don't you just move to California? That's how it's always been out there. Yes. Just a, you know, I know you have your great sunshine and your beaches and you're living the non-compete life, but I want to live that life here in Texas. So I know there are like a numerous legal challenges and I'm sure it'll end up in the Supreme Court and it'll probably not be go the way I want it. But I just wanted to say for the moment, I love this. So good job, government, getting rid of non-competes. And anyone that is in favor of the non-compete agreements, well, I don't know. We'll just have to work it out over beers. But I'm never changing my mind. I'm never going to change. I admit I will never change my mind on this subject. So we'll just have to agree to disagree.
Well, you know, I mean, the thought exercise you have to go through, this is, I don't know what realm of thinking this in, is to think about, like, in what case would Cote Brandon or Random Joe or Jane Worker benefit from a non-compete, right? And, like, there is probably no case that a worker benefits from a non-compete being on them. And vice versa, there probably is no case in which the worker benefits from an executive having a non-compete, right? So then when you have this asymmetry of power that the more powerful benefit from something, then yeah, just trash it, right? like you should be competing on, like, you know, something more than just like some weird regulation. So in general, unless it's exposed otherwise, I would think that most people who are in favor of non-competes, you got to be suspicious about them. Like, what's their angle? What are they up to? Like, what is it? What kind of restrictions could I put on them that would benefit me that they would accept and say was a good idea? Right. Like, what are they going for there? So, yeah, non-competes are, you know, after all, Texas is a right to work state. I think that means you can not only choose what job you want to have, but get fired in less than a second.
Well, that's all true. But I did see, you know, the favorite financial writer, Matt Levine, you know, he sort of brought up, he's always good about bringing up some cases. And I was trying to read some things on the other side of it, like, OK, why is it? But he said, like, in finance, Cote, it's very common to have gardening leave. So it's like there's non-compete, but then you get paid. Like, if the non-compete, it's like 1 year. And he was saying, it's like, the people in finance, I don't think they're going to be that excited about getting rid of it. And then I was like, okay, now if you're going to pay me to, like, just like, I guess, quote unquote, garden, or in my case, I don't know, watch Netflix, like, okay, then we can have a conversation. Then I'm like, suddenly I'm like a little bit more.
Right.
But yeah, nowhere I ever worked, it's never even been a thought, like, much less that, you know, if you were to ask for it, they would just laugh at you and probably almost dismiss you immediately. You know, I know, like, at a very high level, you can get these things. So, but yeah, for some reason, that becomes the default for everyone. I'm talking for the tech workers, for the Jimmy John sandwich makers, for the power washers that are all signing. It's like, sure, if you want to pay us to, like, just our normal salary to hang out, like, okay. I mean, more reasonable, but, you know, I don't even think that will ever happen.
Yeah. No, I mean, that exposes another problem of, like, pure economical thinking is just like, well, if you want to put a price on stuff, put a price on stuff, right? There should be a price on everything.
Yeah.
And then the price of a non-compete, how much is that worth, right? Like, how much are you going to pay for it? Which I don't think happens. Well, that was fun. Non-competes, non-starters. Well, there's also several conferences coming up. There's the Open Source Summit of North America, which has already passed. So if you can get into a time machine, you can go back and see Matt speaking there. There's probably a recording, so you should look that up. The Open Source Summit North America. I talked with several people who were there. They said it was a good conference. Now, as mentioned earlier, I have an executive dinner in Atlanta on May 22nd. If you want to go there, one of someone that I've known for a while, this guy Tony, who worked at as a platform engineer. Before it was called that, at the Home Depot. He actually showed up in several of my books. He's great. He has lots of practical experience. He's a nice guy. He's co-hosting it with me as well. But if you go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/465, you can find a link to that dinner. Now, like a lot of executive dinners, it's this pseudo invite-only thing where, like, you know, you have to be working at some organization that my company would enjoy having presenting customer value to. So not just anyone can show up, but you know, if you work in some sort of like higher level position at a big company and you live in Atlanta, come get a free dinner. It'll be exciting. You can hear me talk about software stuff. Also, there's NDC Oslo, June 12th. I'll be speaking there. DevOps Days Amsterdam, June 19th to 21st. I'll be speaking there. And none of us will be speaking at DevOps Days Birmingham, August 19th to 21st. All of these are in 2004, but I can't guarantee that the dates won't also be on those dates in future years. So with that, Brandon, what do you have to recommend this episode?
Okay, I have two kind of small utilities that are maybe not even new to the audience, but they're new to me. One is Markdown Down, which is basically a website you can just, if you will, paste in a URL and it will give you back the entire site in Markdown, which I just think is convenient. So if you're someone that writes a lot of Markdown or you just want to get the content off a website that's real easy to navigate and edit and read, use Markdown Down, link in the show notes. And then this other one, I think this feature has been around for a long time. I think I got BB Edits, which is sort of like the first great Mac editor, you know, for text editing. And it has just all these crazy features in it. It's sort of like they've been developing it for 25 years. A feature they've had for a long time is called Extract. So what it has is this like crazy, if you will, ability to use regular expressions to like find stuff, right? But it's like the best regular expression find I've ever seen in an editor. And then, and of course, now with the LLMs, you can just have them write the regular expression for you, like write a regular expression that matches this. Mm-hmm. And so what you do is you just get your regular expression built, you put it in the find menu, it will highlight everything that matches. And then if you just want all that stuff, you just hit extract. So instead of having to write yourself like a little, Python script or whatever, it's just like, it just grabs everything. So like, for example, like maybe you got a text file that has like lots of email addresses. Just do a little regular expression, find all the emails, hit extract, gives you a whole file of just that. And it's like, it's just super, super handy. So it's sort of like, if you will, the poor man's, if you will, extraction tool for text files or log files and things like that. So you don't have to get out your Python skills. You can just do it in BB Edit. And I think this feature has been around for like a decade, but it's new to me. So I like it. So check that out too.
There's a sustained thing, BB Edit. Been around forever.
And I look forward for someone to tell me like, well, you can do this in Emacs and here's how you do it. And I was like, I don't know. Because you know what? I don't know.
The operating system of text editing. it can do everything. Well, you know, I always admire these tools that like just extract the text from a page. Like also like the reader view that you see in various mm-hmm. things or yep. Instapaper or that stuff. Because, you know, as someone who hand wrote a MIB parser, it's just like, I can't imagine. You just have to like sit there and just look through hundreds, if not thousands of web pages and just find the patterns and start using them. Or I don't know, maybe there's something smarter and you're just like, yeah, find the biggest chunk of text. And then that's it. Who knows? Probably BB Edit does it. Well, I have two recommendations. One, I was watching a video earlier on my phone and my wife Kim came by and, you know, I paused it to talk with her. And she's like, that's all right. You don't have to pause it. And she looked down. She's like, you know, you're watching it exactly what I'd expect. Some old guy with a gray beard, and who I was watching was I discovered this through the algorithm. So great for the algorithm. You know that Mythbuster guy, Adam Savage. Now uh-huh. I never watched Mythbusters. Seems like it was probably a cool show, but he's got the big YouTube channel, and he does, among other things, he does, you know, the thing. One day, maybe I'll have enough people ask me questions. I can just lazily go into Q&A stuff. It's a great format. But like he does these, I don't know how often it is, a bunch of Q&A stuff. And like a lot of the stuff I don't necessarily care about, but just like his, he's got some magical character to him. I don't know what it is because I didn't used to watch this stuff, but he's just very comforting to watch answering his questions. But you'll appreciate this, Brandon. He is very... I don't think he's not media trained in what we would say, but he mm-hmm. never says like he's very very slick at it. And what's very admirable about it is he's still not polished. He just doesn't use those filler words. Like they even will let him have, I don't know if he edits it or someone else, but they'll let him have, I feel like 10 seconds of dead air. Like all of a sudden he'll just stop and think. and they won't edit it. And so it's just like, I'm watching a lot of them to figure out like, what's the magic here, right? Like what is going on? Plus they are kind of entertaining, or more than entertaining, even though he's talking about like shop tools every now and then, and just whatever. Now my other quick recommendation, I realized this tonight, sometime over the past 5, maybe even 10 years, I didn't realize this happened, but it used to be the chicken leg was my favorite part of the chicken. But now I never eat the chicken legs. I like the chicken thigh. Mm. And so like, I think what you should do, if you're a big fan of chicken like I am, just do a little analysis and be like, has my favorite piece changed over time? Because it's not that this was like a shocker to me, but it really like, I finally kind of said the words in my head and it's like, wow, I don't like chicken legs anymore. Not into them. But
wow,
for the majority of my life, way maybe like 30, 35 years, big chicken leg person. Well, I bet you're happy that you have listened to a recent chicken thigh convert and, go on and on about software, things like that. Matt Ray couldn't make it, but Brandon was here. So we have plenty of good conversation about open source and things like that. If you want to listen to previous episodes, lots of interviews we've done, you can go to softwaredefinedtalk.com/465. There's a whole lot of links that we didn't talk about, and many links that we did that you can also get if you go there to softwaredefinedtalk.com/465. And then, hey, if you don't subscribe to my newsletter and you listen this far, I don't, you're missing out. I'm an older guy. Most of my beard is gray, not all of it. But if you go to newsletter.cote.io, you should subscribe. You don't even have to read it, although opening it would be cool to read it some, but just subscribe. With that, we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
I think you're on mute, Kote.